On this week's 51%, we speak with Dr. Camille Claire to learn more about cesarean sections and what women should expect during recovery.
However their baby comes into the world is a value. However we can support them in their childbirth experience is very, very important.
We also discuss a recent study finding a range of metals in tampons. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Last week, we spoke with journalist and author Rachel Summerstein to learn more about the untold story of cesarean sections in the U.S. Roughly a third of American babies are born via cesarean section, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But when I asked Summerstein about what she wished she knew before her own unplanned C-section in 2016, she said she wished she was more prepared for the possibility of one in the first place. So that is our goal today. Here to help us understand what a C-section entails, when they're used, and what the recovery process looks like is Dr. Camille Claire with SUNY Downstate. Claire is a professor at Downstate's College of Medicine and a secretary of the board of directors for the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She also serves on New York's Maternal Mortality Review Committee and spearheads ACOG's Safe Motherhood Initiative.
Yes, a cesarean birth involves removal of the baby from an incision in the abdomen and also in the uterus. So there are many reasons why an individual is unable to have a vaginal birth. And so that's just the physical process. All the layers from the skin down to the baby are open, the baby's removed, and those layers are subsequently closed under an anesthesia, either a regional anesthesia, or like an epidural, or sometimes general anesthesia, depending on the circumstances.
So how long is the procedure usually?
The average length of time is about 1 hour. It depends on if someone has not had a cesarean birth before. It depends on whether there's any surgical complications or risks to the patient, which may require a longer procedure. If someone's had more than one cesarean birth, it may require a longer period of time to go through all those layers to get to the baby.
Okay. You mentioned potential complications. You know, what are some things that can arise in the span of that hour or so?
Yeah, during a C-section, even afterwards, a C-section has some risks of, it's a major surgical procedure. So there's risks of surgical complications during the procedure, such as excessive bleeding, infection, injury to organs that are nearby the uterus, such as the bladder or the bowels or major blood vessels. Other risks may be from anesthesia, although that's extremely rare. So those are some of the most complicated risks. And then also in future pregnancies, because it's a surgical procedure and there may be scar tissue that develops just from having a cesarean birth. There may be issues with the placenta being easily separated from the wall of the uterus in future pregnancies. So if someone is considering having several children, the more cesarean births, there's a more risk of these issues with the placenta being more difficult separating from the wall of the uterus.
At what point would a doctor decide, okay, it's time we should go for a C-section? You know, what are some things that can prompt it?
Yeah, there are many, many reasons. It's a multiple of factors that determine whether someone needs a cesarean birth. So one is that the patient or someone has gone through the process of labor, and for whatever reason, the cervix is not opening, or the baby's not coming down the birth canal in the normal way. And so that may be one reason. There may be concerns about the fetal heart rate during the process of labor. There may be reasons where the baby's not positioned in a way that can allow for a vaginal birth. There may be more than one baby, two or three babies that may also prohibit why someone may have a vaginal birth. So there's a myriad of circumstances. Those are just some examples. Those are not all of the examples. One other reason is the placenta could be, which is the afterbirth, could be completely covering the cervix. And under those circumstances, someone would not be able to have a vaginal birth. There may be certain infections that if they're concerning, they may not be allowing for a vaginal birth because that would increase the risk of baby obtaining those infections. For example, herpes or HIV, if someone has very high viral load or high viral numbers. So those are just some reasons. Those are not, it's not all inclusive list. There are many, many reasons why someone may deliver by cesarean birth.
Are there instances where someone might want to have a C-section or might choose to deliver this way?
Well, patients have the autonomy and the decision to decide to have a maternal request for cesarean birth. Obviously, if they understand all the potential risks in the future or in the current situation, they may opt to have a cesarean birth. Someone who has had one cesarean birth previously may desire to have another one. So under those circumstances, someone may request to have an elective cesarean birth.
How big is the scar usually?
Well, it depends on the clinical situation. Usually the scar from a cesarean birth can be about 10 centimeters or so, which is the line of the bikini line where someone wears a bikini, if they wear bikinis, almost the length of the lower, the end of the bikini from kind of few inches on one side of the belly button to a few inches on the other side of the belly button.
Okay, so let's get into the recovery process a little bit. You know, what is that like and what kind of timeline are people usually looking at?
Because again, it's a major surgical procedure, the recovery afterwards can be a total of 6 to 8 weeks, assuming there's no complications that we mentioned before. All of those layers that I talked to you about that have to be open have to heal from the inside, out. And so that is a recovery period. The period of time in the hospital can be roughly 3 to 4 days in the hospital, assuming there's no complications during the surgery or afterwards. Those are like the immediate recovery, and then over time, how long it takes someone to recover.
And I'm assuming you're coming in for follow-up appointments at this time?
Yes. So all birthing people, we recommend that they have their first visit at about 2 to 3 weeks after their delivery or their childbirth, and 6 weeks. Now, obviously, if there are any concerns of having a cesarean birth that requires a checkup sooner than that's made. But it's at least somewhere between 1 to 3 weeks is the first visit, and then another follow-up visit somewhere between 6 and 12 weeks.
In terms of pain management and aftercare, what should women know about those weeks after delivery?
Well, very often someone may have a need for stronger pain medications or narcotics in the first 1 to 2 days. And then usually, and obviously everyone's body is different, their healing process is different. And obviously we kind of think about each individual person as we're seeing them and evaluating them. So after that, they may require something like Tylenol or Motrin or something similar for their pain over the period of time. And usually the pain gets better over time as well. Because it's a surgical procedure, usually we recommend that individuals who've had a cesarean birth not do things like lifting more than 10 pounds, not doing, heavy exercise. Also just giving birth in general is about, a 6 week recovery period to not do those things anyway. But also if you've had a cesarean birth, usually a period of 6 to 8 weeks to allow all those, that incision, again, those layers to heal from the inside out. So doing those things can prevent any problems after having a cesarean birth.
If your loved one or partner delivers via C-section, are there things that they can do to make the recovery process easier? How important is it to build up, that support system around you after this kind of delivery?
It's really good to have a support person, whatever that looks like for a birthing person, a family member, partner, can be helpful in helping with some of those tasks that may require in the household, helping taking care of the baby, assisting if any needs, if the person is breastfeeding, determining how they're going to feed their baby, things like that are very helpful. ACOG, which is the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, puts together some really great information for patients that are kind of patient-facing that describes some of these questions that you're asking, and it can be helpful for not only the patient, but their family members, and again, determining how they can best help someone after the period of childbirth.
So you're involved with ACOG's Safe Motherhood Initiative. Tell me a little bit more about that. I know that's been around for a while, but you know, what does that entail? What information are you trying to get out there?
So the Safe Motherhood Initiative began around 11 years ago to address some of the common concerns that have led to morbidity or complications at the time of childbirth and also mortality. So some of these, they're basically developing guidelines for physicians or healthcare professionals that are taking care of birthing individuals to be able to address some of those common reasons for complications, such as bleeding during childbirth, or it's called obstetrical hemorrhage, or high blood pressure during pregnancy, or infection, or which is called sepsis, severe infection, or developing a blood clot during pregnancy. Those are some of the, and recently we're just starting to develop a set of guidelines for someone who has heart disease during their pregnancies. And it's basically guidelines for physicians, for healthcare professionals, that really is almost like a cookbook, a how-to guideline of how to take care of patients when they face some of these challenges during the time of childbirth. We have an app, a free app for your phone that's downloadable, that literally gives us a how-to guideline when you're taking care of individuals to take care of them in the hospital or even at any point that you're taking care of them, wherever you're seeing them.
On that front, I mean, no matter how you deliver, giving birth can be a nerve-wracking experience. You want to make sure that you have that trust between you and your doctor. Do you have any advice in terms of how to pick your provider, or maybe questions to ask them, just how to establish that relationship before the big day?
I think it's really great to, in their immediate community, visiting the birthing facility where they're going to be giving birth is very important. Speaking to their OBGYN in the office to answer their questions. Giving birth is sometimes difficult to plan, and babies come when they know to come. And so sometimes the person that you expect to be attending your birth may not be who is working or who's available. So meeting your healthcare team as you arrive to your birthing facility is really important. Asking to speak to your birthing team, having your questions answered, all those things are important. We work as a team. Your nursing professional, your physician professional, your anesthesiology professional, all here to facilitate the best outcomes as we can, a safe and healthy outcomes for both birthing people and their babies. There are many resources in the state, in New York State in particular, that are addressing some of the quality issues that we talked about. There's also the New York State Perinatal Quality Collaborative that works closely with ACOG to help think about how to reduce that 30% cesarean birth rate for low-risk pregnancies that we talked about. So just, you know, we're working all the time for the patients that we serve and appreciate patient input in their care, which is so important.
Well, Dr. Claire, thanks so much for joining us. Lastly, do you have any myths about C-sections that you would like to dispel for us?
Well, I mean, I think everyone has their own expectations of how the birthing experience may go, whatever that may look like. So, you know, it's hard to think about all the myths people may believe, but really to encourage the birthing person that however their baby comes into the world, is a value. However, we can support them in their childbirth experience as OBGYNs, as healthcare professionals, is very, very important. So really just being a support as a physician, as a healthcare provider is critical so that, again, we can talk to them about what their expectations are during the childbirth process. We know that circumstances can happen where the childbirth experience is going a certain way and then issues may arise. So it may go from a low risk situation where it's expected to go as planned and things happen unexpectedly. So just being supportive to that person to then, and valuing all of the ways that someone gives birth is what we hope to do as OBGYNs.
Dr. Camille Claire is an OBGYN and professor at SUNY Downstate's College of Medicine. She is also a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and serves on New York's Maternal Mortality Review Committee. A new study from the journal Environment International has been stirring up concern online. The study conducted by researchers at Columbia University examined more than a dozen tampon brands sold in the US and Europe and found evidence of 16 different metals inside them, including toxic chemicals like arsenic and lead. The products studied include both organic and non-organic brands. The organic tampons tested were found to be more likely to contain arsenic, while the non-organic ones were more likely to contain lead. All of this may sound concerning to the 52 to 86% of Americans who menstruate and use tampons, but just how worried should we be? Here to tell us more is Jennifer Shearston, an environmental epidemiologist and postdoctoral scholar at UC Berkeley, and the lead author of the report.
This actually is an idea that another co-author on this paper and my PhD advisor, a co-advisor, Dr. Marianthi Anakyamursoglu, had been thinking about for quite a while, but it just took us a while to get funding. And so for me, this research question is both personal and professional. It's personal because I menstruate, I have to manage my period, I use tampons. It's professional because as an environmental epidemiologist, we study chemicals in the environment, including metals. And we already knew that cotton can accumulate metals and that it can be contaminated with all sorts of things like pesticides, for example. And so it seemed kind of an obvious connection. Certainly, it seems something worth studying if tampons are made of cotton, and we know that these things can be present in cotton, what could be present in tampons? So we tested 14 different brands and 30 different tampons, and we tested them for 16 different metals. So those metals are arsenic, barium, calcium, cadmium, cobalt, chromium, copper, iron, mercury, manganese, nickel, lead, selenium, strontium, vanadium, and zinc. That's actually a mix of both essential metals, so metals that you need in your body, and also some non-essential, some toxic metals like lead or mercury.
Now, you don't mention the name of any specific brands or tampons tested in this study. Tell me a little bit more about that decision. Why not?
Well, there was a few reasons for this, but one of the big ones is that we actually tested a variety of different products. So we tested big name brands, we tested smaller brands, we tested store brands, organic and non-organic products that had applicators and some that did not. Some we purchased in the United States and a few that we purchased in the UK or in the EU. And really across all of those products, we found 12 of the 16 metals we tested for. So, for example, we found lead in 100% of the tampons we tested for. And so this suggests that the issue of metals being present in tampons, that it's likely not a brand-specific problem, that this may be a more systemic problem somewhere throughout the manufacturing process or the supply chain.
I was going to say, you know, you mentioned that cotton can get contaminated, but when I read about your study, I was like, how? How did these metals end up here? You know, what are some of the theories that you guys propose?
Well, so we can't say exactly how any specific metals made its way into a specific tampon, but we do have a few thoughts on why this might be happening. And so one of those is that the raw ingredients in tampons, let's talk about cotton, for example, it can accumulate and kind of absorb metals from the soil or from water or from fertilizer that it might be grown in. So that's one possible route. These metals, of course, many of them are, they occur naturally in the environment. So they might just be present in soil or water, or they may be part of a fertilizer. Second, if a raw material like cotton is being grown near a major pollution source, let's say if it's being grown next to a big highway or next to a lead smelter, then it's possible that some of the metals from those pollution sources could like deposit out of the atmosphere onto the cotton. So that's another way. And a third hypothesis is that some of these metals are likely being added as part of the manufacturing process, either as an antimicrobial agent, for example, or as part of a pigment, a whitener, or a lubricant. And that information we're getting from patents.
Well, looking at concentration levels, were there metals that were generally more present than others?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So we've really found a pretty broad range of concentrations. On the high end, we had concentrations for calcium and zinc that were actually quite a bit higher than the concentrations for the other metals that we assessed. So I'm looking right now at my table. That geometric mean for calcium was 39,000 nanograms per gram. And for zinc, it was 52,000 nanograms per gram. And in contrast, the mean concentration for lead was 120 nanograms per gram. And for arsenic, it was 2.56. So that's a really large variation in the concentrations we found.
Okay, so that sounds like a comparatively small level of arsenic and lead. But, you know, to be fair, the government says no amount of lead exposure is safe. I guess just how worried should we be? Or rather, how worried are you after doing this research?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I've been trying to contextualize this for people when I talk to them, because what our study does is it measured whether or not these metals were present in the tampons. But that doesn't tell us any information about whether or not the metals can come out of the tampons and whether they can be absorbed by the body, and thus whether they could be impacting health. And so while we're finding these metals in tampons, some of which I do think are concerning, like lead, because there's not a safe level of exposure to lead, our study is not able to show whether or not that metal might be contributing to any kind of negative health consequence. So this is a first step, and I try to encourage people to pause and say, you know, we just need to know more before we can kind of jump to any conclusions about potential health effects.
And so what would a next step study look like? I'm guessing kind of along those lines about like what can come out of tampons.
Yeah, and that's super important because millions of people could be impacted by this. So actually right now in our lab at Columbia University, Dr. Catherine Schilling, she's the senior author on this paper, she's working on leaching experiments right now to actually see how much of those metals might come out of the tampon in kind of a usual wear scenario. So we're prioritizing that research right now, and hopefully we'll have answers soon.
It also sounds like we could use more research on like vaginal absorption and what can pass into the bloodstream or into the body through the vagina. I'm not sure if this is something that you would be able to comment on, but in your preparation and research for the study, did you come across any other research, I guess, along the lines of that subject?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And I really think we need more research on this important topic. So there's been an increase over the last several years in the number of medications that are being administered vaginally. And so we are getting more data on vaginal absorption from like those control trials, for example, about those medications. But I don't see a lot of research about metal absorption vaginally. And that's really important to what we are finding here.
Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for coming on and sharing your work. Is there anything that I'm missing that you want to make sure people know?
Sure. I think one thing that I think is important is that it's a little bit wild to me that tampons have been in the market since the 1930s, but that to our knowledge, this is the first time someone's ever tested them for metals. I think part of the reason for that might be this historical taboo around talking about menstruation, around talking about periods and vaginas. And when we don't talk about these things, it doesn't just impact our social lives, it also impacts science and the kinds of questions that we think are important and the kinds of questions we ask and that we get funding to. So I'm super excited that people are talking about periods and talking about tampons, because when we don't talk about it, we don't ask important questions.
Jennifer Shearston is an environmental epidemiologist and postdoctoral scholar at UC Berkeley. She's also the lead author of a new study in Environment International on metal exposure in tampons. You can find a link to the study on our website, wamcpodcast.org. Jennifer, thanks again.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for your interest.
One last story before we go, and an update on a bill we've previously discussed on this show. Models have been cheering the passage of the Fashion Workers Act in New York, which passed toward the end of the state's legislative session. WAMC's Samantha Simmons brings us more.
State Senator Brad Hoyleman Siegel says the legislation will support models, protect them from abuse, require modeling agencies to protect models from the use of their images without consent, ensure payments in a fair and timely manner, and increase health and safety protections. The Democrat from the 47th District sponsored the measure and says the more than $2.5 trillion global industry accounts for roughly 6% of New York City's workforce.
Behind the glamour, the big brands, the billboards, part of New York's fashion industry are a far cry from the luxury that we as consumers see. In fact, the industry largely lacks transparency, accountability, and workplace safety standards for its workers.
Hoyleman Siegel says if the bill is signed by Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul, legal loopholes where agencies have escaped accountability would be closed. Democrat Karinas Reyes of the 87th District sponsored the legislation in the Assembly.
This bill represents our values as a state that values workers, who is a state that uplifts labor unions and the right for workers to organize and fight for their protections. This is another piece of that puzzle, and I think a huge win for New York.
The Model Alliance, a New York City-based nonprofit, works to protect and advance workers' rights in the fashion industry. The group says the first-in-the-nation legislation would cover models and content creators. Sarah Ziff is the group's founder and executive director.
Since we established our support line over a decade ago, we've helped thousands of people with a range of work-related issues, from exploitative contracts to sexual harassment and abuse. But it's often like trying to put a Band-Aid over a big gaping wound. Despite hearing the same types of complaints over and over again, there's been a limit to what we can do without having the law on our side.
Nidhi Sunil is a member of the nonprofit's board of directors. Born in India, Sunil moved to New York City to pursue a modeling career. She compared working in the industry to the Wild West, saying she was often taken advantage of.
I know that there's so much more work to be done. I feel like every time we turn a corner in this industry, there's a new challenge that we have to confront and we have to problem solve for, which right now is models' likeness being used without being paid thanks to AI.
Ashley Grace, an actress and former model, says as a teenager, she was raped on a photo shoot set. Grace says she didn't grasp how unsafe she was in the field before pursuing a degree in social work. Grace says the law allows her to continue healing.
Today I get to look back at my 19-year-old self, who was so broken and so afraid, and I get to tell her that one day she will fight for things to be better and that she will win.
Mamaya Jay, a model and actor seen in America's Next Top Model in 2015, says she hopes these new protections support people of color.
Because you can imagine, as a Black woman, I've had horrific things done and said to me at work. For example, we have enough Black women on set, or we have enough Black women that we represent. So me being the third Black person is like, how can you say that to people? So I just really hope that these provisions can also go into just stopping this from happening, over and over and again, and us having the protections needed to fight back when they do happen.
Samantha Simmons, WAMC News.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh, and I lost my cool.